Chapter 14. Echidon. The siren shouted in time with the boom and roar of the ship. Echidon ran through the red-sliced dark. Behind him, Malachurst limped. The rest of the squad was strung out down the passage behind them in loose battle order. That was bad. You did not just run through a ship under battle condition, especially when you had to count almost everyone on board as a potential enemy. They had no choice, though. Time and speed was everything.
"The Blood Angels have punched through the 17th Company cordon," said Kabarak.
"Oh, that's not good," wheezed Malachurst. "There will be reinforcements flooding into these sections soon."
Echidon did not reply.
200 meters to the hoist shaft," said Kobarak.
"They will have shut that down as soon as the Blood Angels breach the hull. It'll be working if we can reach it within the next 5 minutes," said Echidon,
watching the runes dance in his sight, marking their route through the ship.
"The Tech Witch guaranteed it. But not if we miss that window of time," said Malachurst,
an edge of humour in the rasp of his voice.
Echidon was about to reply when an explosion punched through the side of the corridor ahead of them. The blast wave picked him up and slammed him into the wall. Ceramite cracked. Warning runes and static filled his vision. He hit the floor, rising even before his sight cleared. Shreds of metal pinged off his armour. A figure was stepping from the torn ruin of a door. Flame light licked over the crimson of its warplate. Jet's blood marked the edge of its pauldron, and its face was a serene mask of silver. The sword in its hand shone with lightning from winged crossguard to tip. On its chest was the winged skull that had begun to spread amongst the legions still loyal to the Emperor. The Pax Imperialis, they called it, and the warrior who wore it was of the 9th Legion, a son of Sanguinius, a Blood Angel. Echidon brought his pistol up to fire. The Blood Angel's sword cut split the pistol just behind the barrel. The explosion ripped Echidon's hand apart. Pain speared through him for an instant before his body blanked it out. He jerked back in time to avoid the Blood Angel's second cut.
"So fast, so fluid,"
thought a part of his mind, even as his power knife lit in his hand. Blood scattered from the stump of his wrist as he moved. His squad brothers were moving in the corridor behind him, but for this second he did not care. He was a commander, a warlord, but in this moment he was a son of Chthonia as much as a son of Horus. Death, swift and brutal, delivered without hesitation. That was what he had learnt in the dark warrens of the homeworld, and that was what had given him everything he had. It did not fail him now. A bolt round tore past him as one of his squad fired. The Blood Angel staggered as the shell burst in the air beside him. Echidon took the opening and leapt the last meter of space separating them. The Blood Angel brought his sword around in an upward cut that would have split Echidon from hip to collar. Would have, if it had begun a fraction of a second before. Echidon landed inside the Blood Angel's swing. The pommel of the sword clashed against his side. He slammed the elbow of his ruined arm into the Blood Angel's silver face, then stabbed up, knife arm pistoning. Just like the old times, when he and Argonis had walked from the tunnels with red arms to dump their death coins at their chieftain's feet. Ceramite and bone exploded under the knife's power field. A flurry of bolter fire came from the breached door through which the Blood Angel had emerged. There were others there, other figures in red armour. Echidon rammed the Blood Angel back, still stabbing, blood burning to smoke on the knife's power field. Two of his squad brothers were behind him now, close in, firing over his shoulders as he ploughed forwards, shoving the dying Blood Angel into his squad mates.
"Grenades!"
he called into the vox. A second later, a trio of grenades lobbed past him as he pivoted back into the corridor. The blast blew a fresh gout of flame past him.
"Withdraw!"
he shouted. He began to run, looking back to check that Malachurst was still with them. The equerry was 3 paces behind him, his twisted frame turning his run into a loping hobble.
"We have to reach the lift hoisted," began Malachurst.
"I know,"
growled Echidon. Further down the corridor, red-clad warriors stepped from the smoke and flame. They fired. Another man in Echidon's squad went down, his legs torn out from under him.
"Captain,"
said Kobarak over the vox. Part of Echidon's pain-soaked brain noted that the signals specialist was still alive.
Primary command signal traffic indicates that Lord Kyber has committed 2/3 of the Justair into a boarding action against the enemy starforts. They are moving to the teleportation chambers now.
Perfect timing, thought Ekadon.
He did not know how Malik Hurst and the demon creature had engineered such fortune.
It will mean nothing if we can't reach the throne room,
said Malik Hurst, as if answering his thoughts. More gunfire came from behind them. He glanced back. The rearmost pair in the squad had dropped to one knee on either side of the passage and were firing down it in synchronized bursts. There were red warriors lying on the floor, blood lacquering their armor to a gloss shine. The blast doors to the lift hoist were just 10 paces in front of them. Yellow and black chevrons marked their closed teeth. Kobarak sprinted past him to the controls. Malik Hurst slowed.
The doors will not open,
called Kobarak.
The tech witch has betrayed us,
snarled Ekadon. The sensation from his arm was starting to eat through the pain suppressors in his blood. Kobarak shook his head, fingers moving over the control keys set in a panel beside the doors.
Someone has overridden the hoist already. It is in motion. Someone is coming down.
Ekadon turned to look at Malik Hurst, his mouth forming the question. A booming thud shuddered from the passage they had come down. Ekadon turned from the doors. His two warriors were firing back into the Blood Angels. Something was moving beyond the flare of gunfire. The deck shook again. He felt his teeth shake in his jaws. He knew that sensation. Knew it from hundreds of battlefields.
Dreadnought!
He shouted. A tongue of stuttering fire ripped down the corridor towards them. The two kneeling reavers became tatters of bone and armor. A roar filled Ekadon's ears, purring and soaring as the line of fire reached towards them. The dreadnought stepped through the curtain of smoke. It made no pretense of aping the human form. Its torso was a block of machinery set on piston-driven legs. Slabs of armor covered its front. Silver blood drops gleamed amongst the scorches and bullet marks. The cannon mounted on its right arm keened as it spun. Ekadon dived aside a second before fire spat from the cannon. Malik Hurst was not as quick. A cluster of shells ripped through his left leg as he ducked back. He fell, blood scattering as the torrent of fire panned away from him. Another of Ekadon's squad was caught in the open and sawn in two. Ekadon rolled as he struck the deck and came up beside the hoist doors. Kobarak was beside him, not bothering to take cover but still working at the lift hoist controls.
It is almost here, called Kobarak.
I cannot stop it. Just get the doors open or it won't matter.
The dreadnought's cannon fell silent. Ekadon could hear the hiss of liquid coolant fighting to quench the still spinning barrels. Pistons slammed its feet into the deck as it came forwards. There were blood angels in the passage behind it now, running up behind the cover of its bulk. The remainder of his squad opened fire. Rounds smacked into the dreadnought's front and burned into the space behind it. The autoloader in its cannon arm cycled with a thud of metal on metal. Ekadon smiled behind his faceplate. So this was how it was going to end. Not in battle in the heart of the Emperor's domain, not with a knife from behind or a bolt shell delivered for betrayal, but here, in a half-forgotten corridor. He was almost disappointed. Beside him, the doors of the lift hoist clanked and began to open. The dreadnought seemed to pause, its bulk twitching as it shifted aim. Ice prickled across Ekadon's skin. Figures stepped from the opening beside him. He saw armor that was the black of soot and the touch of fire. He saw frost spread across the deck beneath their feet. Furnace light shone from their eyes and the joins in their armor. Ekadon could feel the touch of the warp on his skin. The taste of blood filled his mouth as he looked at them. There were three of them, but their presence filled the space before the doors. They were of the Lupakai, and the demons within their souls had risen from their hearts. Claws grew from their hands. Their helms cracked and elongated. Jaws opened across their faceplates, and heat breathed between burnt iron fangs. At their head walked a bare-headed warrior. The lines of Grail Noctua's face were gone. A grinning skull glowed from beneath translucent skin. Twin horns rose from its brow. Tattered light coiled in its wake.
Murder,
said Tormageddon, in a voice that shivered from the back of Ekadon's skull.
The three Lupakai bounded forwards. The dreadnought fired. Flames breathed from its cannon. Brass casings sang as they struck the deck. The Lupakai were one stride into their charge, legs elongating, armor flowing like muscle. The cannon rounds hit them head-on and vanished. Bakadon heard screams fill his skull, and for a second he thought he saw ghost impressions of faces swirling in the dark around the Lupakai, jaws wide to swallow the bullets from the air. The twin-souled creatures took another step and leapt. The dreadnought twisted to track them, its piston fist rising. Bullets tore into the passage walls. Bolter fire rose from the Blood Angels behind the dreadnought. The Lupakai landed on the front of the machine. The dreadnought twisted, trying to throw them off as they buried talons in its armored skin. They tore at it, worrying and rending. The red lacquer of its armor blistered and charred beneath them. Sparks and burning oil fell from its form. Ekadon pulled himself up, his knife still in his hand, his head filled with screams and the pain of his wounds. Tormageddon was sliding past him towards the dreadnought, unhurried. For a second, Ekadon felt instinct scream at him to bury his blade in the thing's throat. Tormageddon turned its head to look at him. Fire flowed beneath the skin, and blackness filled the sockets that were its eyes.
"Malagust," it said.
Ekadon's head snapped around, eyes going to where the equerry lay at the side of the passage. A black pool glistened around him, spreading wider. The equerry had pulled himself half upright. He was still, though, the fingers of a bloody hand splayed against the wall. Ekadon ran to him. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Tormageddon move towards the dreadnought, gaining speed, a lightning-shot pressure wave building in front of him. The dreadnought managed to clamp its fist around one of the Lupakai. Chisel fingers slammed together, armor shattered, warped flesh became slime. A shockwave of screaming light flashed out. Ekadon reached Malakhurst and dropped to his knee. He put a hand on the equerry's shoulder.
"Malakhurst!"
he shouted. There was no response. He pulled Malakhurst's helm off. The face beneath was pale, the eyes closed. A fresh stream of blood ran down the equerry's chin from the corner of his mouth.
"Oh, Malakhurst, you old bastard, this is not the time to die!"
A high shriek filled the corridor. Ekadon looked around in time to see Tormageddon reach the dreadnought. Its hands were bunches of glowing blades. The air around it was a vortex of red-smeared light. The two Lupakai leapt from the machine's casing just before Tormageddon struck. The dreadnought was torn and dented, but still swung its fist at this new enemy. Tormageddon met the swing with a twitch. An invisible wave slammed into the dreadnought. The fist juddered as though pushing through rock.
"Galus."
The whisper reached up to Ekadon, and his gaze snapped back to Malakhurst. Eyelids fluttered open over pale eyes.
"Get me up, Galus. Get me to the throne room."
For a second, Ekadon did not move. Perhaps it was the sound of his given name coming from the equerry's mouth. Perhaps it was the effort and control in the plea. But he felt something he did not understand.
"Get up, then,"
he growled, and looped an arm under Malakhurst's shoulder. Fresh blood poured out of the torn stump of Malakhurst's left leg. There were wounds in his lower belly, too, raw punctures through ceramite and meat. A mortal would already be dead. Would have been dead from the first impacts, in fact. A space marine, too. But Malakhurst gurgled bloody foam from his mouth and tensed to take his weight on his remaining foot.
"Tough," thought Ekadon. "Tougher than I would have imagined. Cthonia does not breed those that die easily, does it?"
Malakhurst rasped, as though replying to Ekadon's thoughts.
"Oh, sharper move,"
said Ekadon. He began to make towards the hoist doors, red smeared and dribbled in Malakhurst's wake. Light flashed behind them, and Ekadon glanced back. He saw the fist ripped free of the dreadnought's sarcophagus. Amnion and blood sprayed out. The machine's limbs spasmed, pistons locking and firing in time with the last impulses of a dying mind. The Lupakai were amongst the Blood Angels now, lit by muzzle flash, talons and teeth, dragging smoke as they descended. Tormageddon pivoted towards them from above the carcass of the dreadnought.
"Go,"
it said.
We shall follow.
I should have...
hissed Malachurst, the words stretching and slurring as the pain pulled them apart. Ekadon pulled them onto the hoist platform. Four of his squad came with him, firing back into the whirl of fire and blood in the corridor. Kabarak was one of the four, Ekadon noticed.
On Chthonia, I should have left you and your brother in the dark,
slurred Malachurst. The blood on his lips was a clotted froth.
When you tried to take my eye, a gutter discharge with a knife, I should have broken your neck. Well, then you would have no one to drag your carcass across this ship,
snarled Ekadon, and slammed the hoist into motion. Lyak.
He is a blessed creature now, Lorgar had said. He is one with the Prince of Chaos, his essence intertwined with the divine.
Lyak listened and felt the implications unfold in his mind. They almost took his breath away.
You mean to learn his true name,
he said.
You mean to know the name by which Fulgrim can be bound.
He is what the unenlightened would call a demon. His being is now part of the geometry of the divine. The Prince of Pleasure has made him an angel of the highest dominion. Such power is beyond all but the mightiest of the Neverborn. But with that power comes all the laws that govern the creatures of the gods.
To learn his name, though...
That I have already, Lorgar said.
And behind him the doors to Lyak's sanctuary opened. 36 slaves shuffled into the chamber, chains of silver and cold iron clinking from ankles, wrists, and necks. Stigmata covered their flesh, curving in sinuous patterns. They giggled and wept as they moved.
It is here, broken into pieces, held in the thoughts of these blessed souls.
But to hold the complete name, such a name has power. It will hollow out the soul of those who speak it. And if a being knowing his name were to come close to Fulgrim, he would sense it, he would know.
That is why it must be you, my son.
Fulgrim came forwards, wings unfolded from the air behind his shoulders. He grew as he moved, a blur of colour and edges. Behind him, Unkari began to rear off the dais, flesh rippling, its face a mask of delighted rage. They would not survive long. Even without the transcendent power of Fulgrim, they were facing a city, a world. They would die here, and their souls would be taken and spun on looms of agony for eternity. The only way for them to survive was for him to speak the name that was tearing its way out of his mind. Lorgar had known that. He realized. That is why he had only brought a small force. He had lulled Fulgrim into vulnerability. He had misdirected his demon brother's attention by hiding his true weapon behind the shield of Lyak's mask and in the void within his soul. And it had worked. But there was still time for the sword-bearer to die before the blow fell. Gunfire spat from the word-bearers. Explosions tore into Fulgrim's flesh. Blood scattered into the air, burning to indigo smoke. Telekinetic force whipped out, plucked three word-bearers from their feet and crushed them like overripe fruit. The invisible force lashed into the next warrior and met a dome of golden light. A blinding flash stripped the air of colour. Lorgar stepped forwards, his scepter at his side, his hand raised. Fulgrim leapt into the air with a snap of his coils, psychic force shrieking around him, curved swords a blurred halo as they swept down to strike. Lorgar raised his scepter, and shadows unfolded from him, spreading his shape across the ground and air. Fulgrim's swords swept down, and the shadows rose to meet them. Lyak's sight went black, as more segments of the true name clawed into the air. He was sweating blood, shivering, screaming with a choking throat.
You wanted the power of gods,
said a spiteful voice in his mind.
Now taste its truth. No,
came another voice, rising from the void where the true name had coiled in his soul. I never wanted anything of false gods. He felt his knees fold and the staff fall from his fingers. He could hear the roar of voices and the howling of reality. His sight blinked back into focus. Fulgrim was spinning around and above Lorgar, sliding between air and ground, mocking gravity as he cut and cut. Lorgar was moving backwards. His scepter was a blur around him. Thunderbolts flashed where the weapons met, but even with Lorgar's post-human speed, he would have been overwhelmed if it had been a matter of arms alone. The air between them writhed with shadows and shrieking light. Sword blows vanished into folds of light. Splinters of psychic ice fell from bursts of fire. Unkari was oozing forwards now, its psychic bow wake pulling the surrounding throng with it in a howling rush. Lyak saw a clutch of silk-wound humans come too close to the storm around Fulgrim and Lorgar. Their souls ripped from their bodies and spun howling into the air, trailing crimson light. Their corpses dropped and became pulp under the hooves and feet of those behind them. Towering, bull-headed creatures with oiled muscle bellowed as they braced cannons with fluted barrels. Cones of deafening noise roared from the cannons as rounds ripped from their barrels. Two word-bearers fell, Ceramite tearing under the screaming deluge.
I will not end here,
shouted Actea. She was standing tall now, face raised and defiant. Her psychic presence suddenly flared, burning, incandescent. Lyak's sight dimmed at the brightness. Figures fell in the oncoming throng, their eyes boiling in their skulls.
It is not written,
she was calling.
I will not end here.
Another link in the infernal chain of Fulgrim's demonic name snapped into sound. Fulgrim flinched as he twisted and reared. Lorgar struck. Perfumed blood and pearlescent scales tore away as the spiked scepter smashed through armor. Lyak's sight was dimming, his will to keep speaking a fraying rope that he could not hold onto. Spring-legged men bounded forwards, sweeping bladed limbs, grinning with flayed faces. One of them punched a scythe-tipped arm through the neck of a warrior as it flipped past the thinning cordon of word-bearers. It landed a pace from Lyak. He was still kneeling, still frozen as the unholy name regurgitated from his mind. A spring-legged man looked down at him with indigo and green eyes. Its arms swept back. It raised a foot to take a pace forwards and snapped its razor limbs down. A scream of shearing metal. A blur. Shadow and movement congealing into form. A second scream, flesh dissolving into ashes. Kolnar stood above him. The blade slave had drawn his sword. Pulled with its twin from the desiccated corpse of an alien on a world of thirst and desolation, the sword laughed as it scattered blood from its edge. Kolnar's armor cracked as he grew. Red embers and grey ashes poured from the glowing splits. His sword hand had fused with the weapon's pommel. Charred flesh burst through the armor of his arm. The sword was growing, grinning with black iron teeth, sucking in light as it twisted. Hebeck stepped next to his brother. Spines punched through Ceramite, soot scattered from him as he moved, the marble cracked under his tread. Even driven by the will of Unkari, the throng faltered before the pair. Then the wave broke. Kolnar and Hebeck met the charge. Bodies tore apart, meat charring as it fell. A bull-headed giant bellowed and struck Hebeck with a hooded axe. Hebeck took the blow on his shoulder, the hook biting into flesh and broken armor. The bull-headed creature bellowed in triumph and yanked back with all its weight. Hebeck buried his blade in the beast's chest, and its bellow of triumph became a cry of terror. Lyak had seen it happen before. The first thing he had learned about the cursed swords was that they were thirsty. The beastman crumpled, muscle and flesh sucked inwards, crumbling and withering. Hebeck lifted the creature off its feet, still impaled, as the blade ate its life. Cries sliced through the surrounding horde. Even over the roar of the true name filling his mind and ears, Lyak could hear them and understand them.
Anakatis!
Came the cry, echoing in the warp and reality alike.
Anakatis! Anakatis!
The hunger, the promise of the pit.
Even here, in the heart of the Eye of Terror, they remembered the swords and what they had killed. Lyak vomited a stream of sounds. Fulgrim fell back, shivering, shrinking, and Lorgar was pressing his attack, hammering his brother back and down. Lyak could feel the last syllable of the name sitting in the depths of his soul like a red-hot coal. It was so close that he could taste it. It tasted of honey and raw meat. He could not do it, though. Grey armor. He could see grey armor and feel the heat of a pyre as the creeds of false gods poured into the night sky on tongues of flame.
"We burn the past to make the future," said a thought.
Pain spiraled in its wake. Echoes and images clung to his mind like a bruise. He felt the last syllable rise to his mouth. The vision of battle snapped back into motion. Sheets of light were scything through the air, and the throng of bodies was a bloody wave rolling into the gunfire and blades of the last few at Lorgar's side. Fulgrim reared from the ground, swords in hand, bloody wings a hood behind his head. Blood glossed the crimson of Lorgar's armor. His eyes were sunken in his face. He turned, dragging the head of his mace behind him like a comet pulling its tail of flame through the night sky. Fulgrim met the blow with crossed swords, but the force of it cannoned him backwards. Blood, so dark that it was almost purple, streaked the ground. Unkari bellowed. Until now, Fulgrim's consort had left the demigods to their fight, but now it came across the bloody ground in a blur. The exalted demon had sloughed off its previous shape. Coils of thick flesh lay on the ground in folds. Its pudgy mockery of Fulgrim's face was gone. Whipcord muscle and deathly white skin sheathed long limbs. Fleshy horns curled above a snarl of glass-shard teeth. Light bent and shattered around it, lashing at eyes that tried to look. Lorgar straightened to meet the exalted demon, hand raised as though in piecemeal greeting. Fulgrim stirred at his feet, bloody, blades and wings rising. Lyak spoke the last syllable of the name. Argonis. The slaughter tide was white-streaked red. Ashen water and blood scattered from the charging warriors as they ran up the slope of the hill. They came from every direction, screaming with battle joy, rattling with skulls and chains. Not an army, but a wave driven by shared hunger. Argonis could see other shapes amongst the world-eaters, spindle-limbed creatures that ghosted and steamed in the grey downpour, canine shapes that shook with gore-matted fur and brass scales. An ache filled his skull as he looked at them. Gunfire spat from the edge of the oncoming tide. Bolt rounds exploded against palisades. Grenades lobbed through the air, bursting amongst the tiers of iron warriors. A spear of plasma burned above Argonis's head and tore an arm from one of the iron circle in a flash of sunbright light. It was nothing, though. A wild scattering of shots, unaided and undisciplined. The iron warriors held their fire for an instant, and then opened up as one. Rounds and energy blasts soared through the air, first a handful and then a growing cascade to rival the falling rain. This was no volley fire. Each shot had been chosen and placed. Argonis watched as the shots tore at the creatures running beside the world-eaters. He saw a beast of brass and fire rear as a beam of plasma cored its skull and sent molten metal scattering into the rain. Some world-eaters fell. A lascannon blast reached for a jackal-headed demon, but the creature jerked forwards an instant before it hit, and the arc of light bored through three warriors with a puff of atomized matter. Dying demons dragged down warriors as they dissolved out of being. Stray rounds found unintended targets. But for the Iron Warriors, this was not about killing. It was about stealing strength from the tide as it engulfed them. The first world-eaters were at the bottom of the rise. The Iron Warriors' fire ceased.
"Now!" called Perturabo.
And explosions stole the sound from the air. The earth between the world-eaters and the first line of Iron Warriors rose in a wall. It seemed to hang for a second, the sound going on as it loomed above. Then it crashed down again, pouring earth and ash back onto the ripped ground beneath. The nearest world-eaters vanished as the momentum of their charge carried them into the pit that had opened before them. Argonis could hear the roars of rage as they fought to rise under the falling debris. Others were caught at the edge of the blast and tumbled upwards, ragtoys of meat and shards. The tide swept on, driven by fury, blind to anything but the song of the nails in their skulls and the promise of bodies falling beneath their blades. The ground dropped beneath their feet. Loose earth fell with the rain.
"Second configuration,"
said Perturabo, his voice clear over the echo and roar. The iron warriors on the hill slope began to move. Squads with high shields moved forwards as the temporary palisades were pulled into new positions. Tanks drove into place, their hulls forming walls beside steel barriers and rows of interlocked shields. Thousands of warriors, fortifications and machines had redeployed in seconds. As the first world-eaters came out of the pits blown by the mine charges, they met not a wall, but open corridors of shields and palisades leading further up the slope. Some ran at the palisades and shield walls. Only a warrior who dreamed of his own death would make such a charge. Armies had died across the ages of humanity when gripped by such battle madness. But they were blessed of the god of blood and war, and they lived only for the certainty of death and the song of slaughter. Argonis felt the charge hit home, shuddering, vibrating through ground and air, and the line held. The iron warriors still did not fire. The will of their lord held their guns silent. To most forces, that would have been suicide. But these warriors had been fighting on ammunition-starved battlefronts for years. They met the slaughter tide with blunt iron and muscle. Shield squads surged forwards an instant before the world-eaters struck, ramming thick plasteel forwards with genhanced strength. Power weapons lashed sparks from the shields. Iron warriors fell, but the shield walls closed, and iron fists and maces battered back at the tide. A berserker, chain-wrapped and screaming through the grin of a skull helm, leapt at a palisade wall. His axe hooked over the top, and he hauled himself up. An iron warrior swung a hammer down at the berserker, two-handed, the head cold metal. The world-eater raised a chain-wreathed hand to meet the blow. Ceramite and bone shattered. The world-eater bellowed and flung out his shattered arm. The chains hanging from his forearm arced up, tangling the iron warrior's hammerhead as it rose for another blow. The berserker yanked down. The iron warrior behind the wall jerked forwards, still gripping his hammer. Still hanging from the palisade, the world-eater rammed his helm into the iron warrior's faceplate, shards of crystal scattered from shattered eyepieces. The iron warrior was trying to recover as the berserker pulled himself over the palisade and hacked his axe into the back of the struggling warrior's neck. Blood blushed the rain-streaked air. The world-eater raised his axe to the sky, and the roar of the tide behind him rolled like thunder. Argonis watched Perturabo as the Primarch saw his sons fall, and their blood began to mix with the mud. The rain was getting heavier, the drops black as they fell, and crimson as they splashed.
"Third configuration," said Perturabo into the vox.
The iron warriors moved again, pulling back, switching position and surging into gaps in the world-eaters' lines, with tanks and shield-bearing squads. Wide channels now opened in their formation, unfolding before the sons of Angron even as they charged. Sections of the iron warriors had pushed out and down the hill, so that they were deeper in the horde than before. Seen from above, the progression of the battle would have seemed like a flower unfolding its petals as it drowned. The world-eaters poured in. The iron warriors held them back still, withstanding the fury of the 12th Legion's assault. The armour of all those on the hill of rubble was red-slicked and ash-clogged now, and still the world-eaters came charging up the hill to break against the metal of the maze of shields, tanks and walls. Argonis saw a palisade give way under the weight of blows, saw the iron warriors behind it bludgeoned down and hacked apart. He saw a metal gauntlet rise from amongst the butchers, grasping, fingers flexing in air. A chainsword churned it into a bloody stump. All across the hill, the lines drawn by Perturabo's warriors were bowing, folding, creaking under the pressure of blind fury.
"We cannot stand much longer," said Forex. "Give the order to fire, my lord."
Perturabo gave a single shake of his head.
"He is coming," he said.
"How can you know?"
asked Argonis. Perturabo did not reply. Argonis looked up as the sky above flashed. Whips of lightning spiderwebbed across the sky.
A cry of rage rose through the air to greet the thunder, and then another, and another, the ragged war cries fusing together into a single sound. The clouds swelled and billowed, red folding with black, flame yellow with grey.
The word came from behind Argonis, and he turned to see that Volk had raised his head to the sky. Thick rain was running down the steel of his face. The chrome of his eyes burned with reflected lightning, and his mouth was open. The voice that came from it growled with the clack of closing breeches and charging weapons.
"The Red Angel cometh."
A shadow moved across the ceiling of the sky, a darkness beyond the clouds, black amongst the colours of fire. The World Eater's shouts were a single rolling voice now, as they hacked and battered at the Iron Warriors. The shadow in the sky grew. Perturabo did not look up. Argonis realized that the Primarch's eyes were closed. The clouds split, spiraling, pulling the cords of lightning into ropes as they reached towards the summit of the hill. A shape fell with the cyclone. Wings spread from its shoulders, ragged skin taut in the gale. Brass armor coated a body of gore-slicked muscle. A mane of cables streamed from behind a head of flayed muscle and charred bone. Argonis looked at it and felt his nerves scream at him to run. His head was a ball of agony. Neon light streaked his vision. The reek of hot metal and hacked meat flooded his mouth as vomit rose from his throat. He could not feel his hands hanging loosely at his sides, fingers slack on forgotten weapons. Across the hillside, eyes rose and the flow of battle stuttered. Perturabo opened his eyes. Weapon pods armed, plates of metal unfolded from his frame, layering deflecting edges over thick armor. A plow-fronted helm clamped into place over his face. The iron circle stepped close around him, shields locked, dead machine eyes bright. Volk was at his side, almost the size of the Primarch, his eyes now fires in the mask of his face. Perturabo looked up, and above him, the Angel of Slaughter that had once been a Primarch fell back to Earth.
"Fourth configuration," said Perturabo calmly.